Now, you mentioned that you were in a fraternity.
Correct.
Was the fraternity important to you? What was fraternity life like?
It was important. When I came here, as I told you, I was very young and unsophisticated and naive, and I really didn't expect to get into a fraternity because that, too, sounded like something that was for all the people who came here from prep school. But I went through the rush week, which was at the very beginning of school, and ended up being invited to join two fraternities, and I accepted one, and that one was Phi Gamma Delta out at Preston and Jackson. And my best friends throughout my undergraduate years were my fraternity brothers, most of them classmates. Obviously it was very important then. I have not seen many of them a lot since school, except occasionally at reunions. I now see probably other people in my class other than my fraternity brothers more often than I see some of my fraternity brothers from those days. One of my good fraternity brother friends has been particularly close for the last 10 or 15 years, although he was 2 years ahead of me, and he's now on the board of trustees with me, Greg Castle, and he and his wife and I and my wife are friends, and we visit in their home. They now live in Lexington. I became the president of my fraternity, although we were taught that fraternities were, you know, a lifetime thing, to me now, fraternities can sometimes operate to prevent you from having the bonding with your entire class or with others in the school that is important for good alumni to have, you have to overcome, I think, the fraternity bond in some ways to become as effective an alumnus of the school as many people are and more people ought to be. But it was a good place to be. I mean, they served good food. I ate my meals there. I slept there in my sophomore, junior, and senior years. I came to Washington Lee, as you might imagine from my scholarship stories, on a very thin budget, and did not have a lot of money to spend, so I couldn't have a room out in town. The fraternity house offered me the most inexpensive place to stay.
Was that true? That was the best deal, mm-hmm. to live at the fraternity house?
Yes, and it was, in those days, it was essentially the only place to eat meals. Mm-hmm. That was just before Evans Dining Hall, which I think was built right after I left law school. But in those days, there was a freshman dormitory and no other sleeping facilities that the university had for students, except for some married students' housing facilities. And there was no dining facility at all, so you either had to eat your meals out in town or at a fraternity house.
Was anybody not in a fraternity?
There were some, but not a lot.
And where would they eat?
Some of them would eat together. I guess they would eat at places like the Southern Inn and whatever the other food establishments are in town. There was something in those days called the Beanery, which may have been a place where people who were not in fraternities could eat. That was a university facility somewhere on the back campus. But I always associated that with athletes who had to eat training meals, football players and such. But maybe there were other facilities that I just never knew about. But I never gave that any real thought either, because I was going to eat my meals at the fraternity house.
Now, you mentioned athletes. You were here during the cheating scandal.
I was.
What was it like to be here at that time?
I believe that happened at the end of my sophomore year, which would have been in 1953. And I remember that there was a lot of quiet conversation, secret conversation among a lot of people about something going on. And then we heard that a lot of people had left school who had been guilty of honor system violations, and that a lot of them were football players, scholarship football players. And I think it had a striking effect on the student body. And it was right after that, I guess, that the board decided to do away with big time athletics on the ground that Washington and Lee's academic program was really not appropriate and created too many conflicts for people who were here on athletic scholarships who maybe should be getting their education somewhere else. I always thought, I don't know how much I thought about it really at the time, but I thought it was the right decision, and I thought the university did the right thing in stopping playing some of the football opponents that we played when I first got here. I mean, I can remember playing the University of Maryland on Wilson Field when Maryland was ranked number one in the country, and Washington Lee was just wiped up. Although we also had that wonderful victory of my freshman year over the University of Virginia, when it was the only loss UVA had all year long, and Washington and Lee just played a wonderful football game and beat UVA 42-14. And that too was here on Wilson Field. But that was the highlight of the big time football program while I was here. But I had a fraternity brother my freshman year who was here on an athletic scholarship. His brother is here this week, Ben Bolt, who's here with his wife Ann, and they've come back to several alumni college programs. He came here for 1 year, and he was a freshman, although he was older because he'd served in the Korean War. But he came back here for a year in my senior year, and then he went away, and I graduated eventually from a college in Mississippi, and I never saw him again until he took an alumni college trip with us to Russia 3 years ago, and we met at Dulles Airport as we were ready to leave on that trip. And I haven't seen his brother, who was did not graduate from Washington and Lee, but was here for a couple of years as a football player.
Now, were you involved in sports at all?
Intramural sports. No varsity sport. I wasn't either big enough or good enough. But I played intramural just about everything, at least once.
Tell me about that.
Oh, my. Well, I played football, basketball, softball, intramural. I wrestled once. I played volleyball. I bowled in intramurals. I played handball once. I played ping pong. I mean, there was every kind of virtually every kind of sports activity in intramurals, and I think I did it all. I may have played tennis, although I'm not sure about that. But I played golf once, intramurals. Some of these I did more regularly than the things I did once, but I tried to wrestle once, and I can remember trying to lose weight to make the weight, which was a number of pounds below my current weight. But even then it was a strain, because I had to stand in a hot shower and sweat all afternoon and do whatever I could to reduce my weight by another pound so I could make the weight limit. Mm-hmm. And they fed me a big steak that night at the fraternity house. And then the next day I went out and wrestled and got pinned right away. but that was my intramural wrestling experience.
Well, I had no idea there was that much variety.
Yes. I mentioned to you I spent one night in the old Stonewall Jackson Hospital, and that was what the doctors thought was a possible concussion from playing intramural football. I remember I was passing the football, and one of the players on the other team tagged me so hard that I went back and landed on the back of my head, and they took me to the hospital for just to watch me overnight. I thought I was fine, but they made me spend the night in the hospital.
Well, now you can say you slept in Stonewall Jackson's house.
And I guess I can say that, and I will. I slept in Stonewall Jackson's house for one night.
You and a lot of other Washington.
I think that's right. Let me tell you about one experience that you haven't asked me about and that you wouldn't know about without a lot of research, but that you probably ought to know about. You know, I guess, that Alvin Barkley died in Lexington at the mock convention.
You were here.
I was not only here, but Alvin Barkley died with his head in my hands because I was on the platform. And I've seen some of the old clips of the 1956 mock convention. And not for this mock convention, but maybe 4 years before, in one of the little promotional pieces that the students did, they used a clip of that old, from that 1956 mock convention. And there I am sitting on the stage. It was in the old Arimas gym, and there was a platform, and there were maybe half a dozen officers of the convention, and I was the secretary of the convention because of my interest in politics and student government and all that sort of thing, and I was then in law school, but they made me an officer of the convention, and Alvin Barkley was giving his speech, which most people have heard about, and he had delivered that phrase, the last phrase that he mentioned, I'd rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than sit in the seats of the mighty. And with that, his head kind of went down, almost like he was bowing his head in prayer. But then his hand somehow flopped across the podium in front of him, and there were all these microphones set up, and some of them went scattering in different directions, and he then collapsed, and he fell right behind my chair, and so I turned around and put my head under his hand, and he kind of wheezed three times, like three gasps of air, and then he was dead. And I knew he was dead. There were the other people, all the students on the platform. I mean, his wife was out in the first row, and President Gaines and all sorts of other people were out there. And all I remember was saying to whoever was the chairman of the convention, said, maybe you ought to ask everybody to stand for a moment of silent prayer, because, I mean, I just knew he was dead. I mean, there was no time for any emergency medical people or anything to get there. And that happened, and I really don't know, I can't remember all the details of what happened after that, but the convention was postponed for a week. Barkley's widow urged that it be continued after that week, and his funeral was in Washington sometime in the middle of that week, and we resumed the convention and finished it a week late the following weekend. But that was, as I also think, that was the first person that I ever saw dead who I knew was dead, and here I was in law school at the time. I'd never seen a dead person to my knowledge until Alvin Barkley died.
That's quite a beginning.
Yes.
Did you become a celebrity? Did people interview you?
No, not that I know of. There were other more important people to interview. I just was, you know, one of several people there.
Well, you know, today you'd have been on CNN within 2 minutes.
Probably, I might have sold a book. if I'd had an agent or played my cards right at the time.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it's interesting doing these interviews because I know these major moments in history. But you know, you get involved in talking to somebody and you don't really do the arithmetic and realize
that. I mean, that was,
of course I should have realized you would have been.
That occurred while I was here, that's right.
Not only when you were here, but you were central. Mm-hmm. So you were real involved in student politics.
Yes, I was, there were two political parties on the campus then, the University Party and the Independent Party. And the way it worked in those days was that the University Party consisted of 10 fraternities, and it was the Red Square fraternities and five others were in the University Party, and the other seven fraternities were in the Independent Party. So the Independent Party typically always lost the elections. And what was elected was the president of the student body and maybe two other offices, like secretary or so, I don't remember what the offices were. And then there would be elected the president of each of the four big dance weekends. The fall dances, fancy dress, spring dances, and finals. They were elected offices. And so each of the parties sort of put together a slate, and they'd have to keep different fraternities happy by making sure that ones got nominated. But it didn't always work out that way with only seven offices to fill, and with 10 fraternities in the big clique, they called it, the big clique and the little clique, the University Party and the Independent Party. So when I was in my senior year, maybe, one fraternity switched allegiance and came into our party, and then another fraternity did that so that it became 9-8 and it made it much closer. and I guess we elected the president of the student body the year we had 9 people. And the following year, my first year in law school, my party nominated me or put me up for president of the student body and had the alignment of fraternities remained the same, I would have been elected. But on the night before the election, through some, I guess what was typical student politicking in those days, the other party went to one of the fraternities in our party and persuaded them to switch their allegiance on the eve of the election. And so that took 60 votes from my party and gave it to the other party. So I lost the election for president of the student body.
So did people vote strictly along party lines?
That was pretty much the way it worked, yes. Because it was in each fraternity's self-interest to vote for the party in which it was a member, because its turn would come to have a prestige office, either president or the, you know, particular dance head. And it was a rarity for somebody to be so popular that enough votes could be siphoned off from the other party to elect that person. Although, I mean, everybody went through the motions of it every year as if it was a truly contested election. But the minority party rarely won an office. It happened occasionally.
So when you arrived, say, as a freshman, and you're choosing your fraternity, at that point, do you have any idea
some
about
people,
all this?
Some people probably did. I didn't have a clue. No, I had no idea. I mean, the other fraternity that gave me a bid to membership was one of the big clique fraternities, but I didn't know that at the time. I just sort of went with what seemed comfortable to me.
This is complicated politics.
Oh, it is. It is. But what an education for the real world.
Really? Well, you know, I've heard allusions to Big Quick and Little Quick, but you're the first person who's really explained it to me.
I don't know how long that process continued, but that's pretty much the way it was during my 7 years here. There were 10 fraternities against 7, then there were 9 against 8, and then there was some shifting back and forth. And I don't know what it went to after I left, but it was very important to some people, and each of the leaders of the fraternities were expected to get their membership solidly to vote for the ticket of the party in which they happened to be a member. It's kind of like Red Cross blood drives in those days. Twice a year, the Red Cross would come up and have a blood drive, and whichever fraternity got 100% or the closest to 100% would win a keg of beer. Well, that was very important to my fraternity and a lot of fraternities, so they would get 100% in order to get a keg of beer. Even if people were not qualified, if you showed up and offered to give blood, even if you were rejected for medical reasons, that of course counted. And so there was great social pressure to, particularly in my fraternity, to have 100% because they wanted that keg of beer. And I wasn't a beer drinker, but I went and gave blood religiously.
So who was supplying the keg of beer, the Red Cross?
I'm not sure. It probably was the Interfraternity Council. I don't think it was the Red Cross. I'm not sure they could.
Talk about interesting politics.
I assume it was the Interfraternity Council that probably donated a keg of beer to the winning fraternity in an effort to do our civic duty and support the Red Cross.
And the keg of beer.
And the keg of beer, right.
Well, this has been a real education for me. I really have learned a lot. So am I correct in understanding that everybody really in his heart of hearts wanted to be in the Big Click, but he wasn't? Not everybody was?
No, it didn't work that way. But I think, by and large, most of the fraternities that were perceived to be the better fraternities were Big Click fraternities. Just by way of illustration, at that time there were 2 Jewish fraternities at Washington and Lee, because obviously in those days none of the other fraternities would take a Jewish member. So there had to be Jewish fraternities, and there had to be 2 apparently for there to be some alternative. And clearly the preeminent Jewish fraternity was Zeta Beta Tau, which was in the Big Click, and Pi Epsilon Phi, which got whichever Jewish students ZBT didn't want, was in the Little Click. And there were some other fraternities that were perceived as being not as strong. I always thought that my fraternity was one of the leaders of the Little Click. It was, I mean, it had good people, and nobody looked down their nose at my fraternity, but there were people who looked down their nose at some of the other fraternities, and most of those were in the Little Click. But was it important to a lot of people? Obviously it was important to some, most people, I think, didn't lose a lot of sleep over it.
Well, now you're giving me such an education. Can you answer the question that nobody else has been able to answer for me? Probably. Why is Red Square called Red Square?
Well, my guess is it has something to do with the Red Square in Moscow, because there is a square, and all the fraternities are brick, so somebody probably just called it Red Square and the name stuck. Now, do I know that as a fact? No.
Nobody seems to know. It's just always been.
It's always, that's right. It's like, why not?
Why is the colonnade the colonnade?
Right.
Wow. This, oh, I just can't thank you enough. I've really learned a lot. You were in the Glee Club.
Yes, I did the Glee Club kind of like I did wrestling for intramurals. I did it once, and I'm not a trained singer, and I think some of the people who were recognized that my voice didn't mesh with the rest of them. So my Glee Club experience was not anything that lasted very long. I may have been in the Glee Club my freshman year or my sophomore year, but certainly not beyond that.
This was not a highlight of your career at Washington.
No, it was not. I can remember we went over to Charlottesville and we sang over there once, and I can remember a couple of the songs we sang, When the Days Dwindle Down to a Precious Few, whatever that song is. That was one of the songs that we sang in the Glee Club, but that, no, I would not remember my Glee Club experiences at the top of the list of my recollections of Washington and Lee.
Well, what is? What's at the top of your list?
Well, you got to understand that most of my recollections of Washington and Lee have been recent recollections because I'm living a different Washington and Lee life over the last 15 or so years. I had a wonderful time here. I used to tell people that I spent 4 years in undergraduate school and then 3 years in law school, and that if Washington and Lee had a medical school, I would have stayed here for that. And that was a bit of an overstatement, but it expressed my view about how much I liked life here and the idea of leaving Lexington and leaving Washington and Lee and going somewhere and going to work was certainly not continuing this wonderful experience, but I had to do it. I went to work. I went to Baltimore. I became a lawyer. I had a career to develop in the practice of law, and I didn't have a lot of connection for a long time with Washington and Lee as an alumnus. I was class agent for my class for a year or so in the late 50s or early 60s. I occasionally went to a Washington and Lee alumni gathering in Baltimore. I came back to Lexington just a couple of times, but not for any kind of formal alumni reunion activity until my 20th reunion in 1975. I came back for that. And then I came back again in 1980, and that was the first time I brought Heather. We had met the year before. And at that point I just decided, with her support and enthusiasm, because she fell in love with the place immediately, that I want to get involved and get more active as an alumnus. And so I did that, beginning in about 1980. I became a class agent again, and I became the vice president of the annual fund. Eventually became the chairman of the annual fund for 2 years in the late 80s. I got elected to the law council in the 80s. I became the president of the law council. Then I got elected to the board of trustees in 1991. And while all this was going on, beginning in the mid 80s, I started attending the alumni college, and we got hooked on that. So we come back to Lexington for alumni college. We come back for law council meetings. We come back for trustee meetings. We come back for any other meetings that anybody will have and invite me to. As I say, just give me a ticket and I'll be here. So my recollection and my feelings about Washington and Lee are so much colored by my recent experience that it's hard to separate that out and think back to a lot of things that went on 40 years ago.
Well, you're doing a good job this afternoon.
Well, you're testing my recollection on some things.
Well, I do notice you have a 35 on your name tag. That's one of the higher numbers here.
Yes, it's the highest one right now.
It is the highest?
Yes. Yeah, Heather and I have been to more alumni college programs than anybody else. We're one up on Jim and Joe Balaji.
I'm impressed. I didn't think anybody could be up on Jim Balaji on anything.
Well, he would like to get ahead, I think, and he may one of these days. He has a little more time than I do right now, but I devote a lot of time to the alumni college.
And do you find that it really is a continuing education kind of thing?
Yes, it's not like, I mean, if you spend a week in an alumni college, it is not like going to graduate school and really concentrating on something in a in an intense and extended way. But it's informative. The experiences are wonderful experiences. You've sat in on some of the programs. You know the kind of participation there is. We have fascinating teachers, and it's the sort of the interdisciplinary nature of it that is so fascinating. If you're here to learn about a country, you learn about history, you learn about geography, you learn about culture, you learn about art and music and literature and just all those sorts of things that are woven together by Rob Fury and the way he plans these so skillfully. Rob is I've said this before and I'll say it on this tape, I think he's one of the wonderful assets that this university has, and that these programs are the best thing that the university has ever done for its alumni. And I'm just committed to getting as much of a benefit from them as I can. And I've traveled now, I counted up with Heather this morning, I think we have done 15 alumni college abroad trips.
Really?
And we're going to go to Turkey in September, and we're going to go to Africa next January. So it won't be long before I hit 20.
Jim Ballinger will be nipping at your heels.
He'll be doing as many of those as he can right along with us. Yes.
Now let's see, there were a couple of things. How long have you been the trustee?
5 years. Although this counts as my sixth year. I was elected to the board in October of or sworn in October of 1991.
And would you say there have been dramatic things that you've been involved with as a trustee? What are the highlights of being a trustee?
Well, I wasn't a trustee when we dealt with, the two or three major things, I guess, that the trustees have dealt with over the years are the decision we talked about doing away with Division I athletics back in the 1950s, and the co-education decision in the mid-1980s were obviously two very critical things, and I was not on the board for either of those. But the board is continues to wrestle with what are always important issues about how the university should be run, about how it manages itself, how it plans for the future, how it pays for the things that it has to pay for, to keep making this a better institution in a world where every educational institution is trying to upgrade itself and achieve more important things, or be better than it was yesterday. Washington Lee is doing that, and Washington Lee is considering its size and its sort of relative isolation in Little Lexington, Virginia. It's got wonderful national attention, both the undergraduate school and the law school. So the board deals with all the sorts of things constantly that go into making this as good an institution as it is.
Now, you say you were not on the board at the time of co-education, but I'll bet you had some point of view about the issue of co-education.
Well, I'll tell you, my view at the time, as the debate was going on, and I did not have the information that the trustees had. I had some of it. My view, and I remember that the trustees authorized a poll of some sort to be taken of alumni, and I can't tell you exactly how I filled that poll out, but I probably said, as I suspect a lot of people did, that all of the things being equal, my preference would be to keep the university all male, because that's the way I remembered it, but that if it were a question of preserving the quality of the institution, then I thought that we ought to accept women rather than see the quality of the university go down. I understood the arguments then for, apart from quality, for admitting women, and I sympathized with it. My view today is much stronger that it was the right decision. As soon as the decision was made, I supported it wholeheartedly, although not everybody, I think, was prepared to go quite as far as I was, at that point. What I did know was that the admission figures for entering classes of students had been declining steadily over a period of about 20 years. What I did not understand at the time the board made the decision was the practical effect of Washington and Lee's trying to preserve its single-sex education and competing for a steadily shrinking pool of male students who only wanted an all-male education. And that number, even among male students, was getting smaller and smaller because of just changing habits and culture. More students were looking for co-education by the time we got to the 1980s. So the board made clearly the right decision, and I think it's been proved to be a right decision by the result of what has happened since. All of the things being taken into consideration, the transition was very smooth. You had to work your way through 4 years of classes where there were some students who continued to take pot shots, I guess, at having women on the campus. But now that that's behind us, the women are strong students. I think the board and the administration were surprised at how quickly the numbers of applications increased for both males and females, and how many females they could accept, and how strong their qualifications were. And the university has only been strengthened by the quality of the students who've come here ever since, both male and female.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. Now, you said you were on the alumni board. Were you involved in Fraternity Renaissance in any way? Was that going on while you were?
No, I was not on the alumni board. I was on the law council.
I was on the
law council. I was on the law council during the mid to late 80s.
Mm-hmm. So did you see, were you aware of what was going on with Fraternity Renaissance?
Well, I knew about the decision to what you describe as Fraternity Renaissance. I mean, it's really at least a two-step process. One was upgrading the quality of all of the fraternity houses, which were in pretty sorry shape, and secondly was the university taking over ownership and control of the fraternity houses so that they could monitor the conduct and the upkeep of those houses in which students are permitted to live sort of as tenants. And something had to be done about having students living in houses that they would trash for 4 years and leave to people coming along behind them without any regard to the conditions that they were bequeathing to their juniors. So I knew about all of that when it was going on for a couple of reasons. One is that when I became the the chairman of the annual fund in 1987, I was invited to attend trustee meetings in that capacity. And I'm not sure whether it had been done, and if so, how effectively before that, but Jim Ballingy was then the rector of the board, and Ferris Hotchkiss came and talked to me about doing this job, and I accepted, and he told me that that I would be invited. And he said, none of your predecessors for the last several years has been interested enough to accept the invitation of coming to the board meetings. And I said, this is wonderful. I'd be happy to attend the board meetings. And so I started, and so for 2 years I was invited to all of the board meetings as chairman of the annual fund. Then there was a gap of maybe a year when I didn't go to any meeting. But then I got invited again for a year as president of the law council, because Jim Ballingy also decided during that period that both the president of the Alumni Association and the president of the Law Council should be invited also to attend trustee meetings and to give a report and to be able to just sit in and get a sense of what the board does. So I was almost a regular in attendance for several years before I got elected officially to the board 5 years ago.
Well, that was a real opportunity to get groomed, wasn't it?
Well, I think that's one of the things that that the board is doing now. It looks at people who hold these positions of alumni leadership and certainly considers them as prospective members of the board of trustees. And I've not been the only one who's been in a position like that who has subsequently been elected to the board.